Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk from the Scottish Book Trust. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode. We went to a bunch of festivals to put this podcast together, and it was a lot of fun. We went to the Edinburgh International Science Festival, where we caught up with Lynn Anderson and Dr. Kathy Charles, talking about forensic psychology and crime writing. We went all the way to the Brisbane Writers Festival, where we met Scott Westerfield, who's a young adult author, and he's responsible for the Ugly series, which is highly acclaimed and hugely popular. Then we came closer to home at Glasgow's I Write Festival, where we met up with Jerry Hassan, and we talked about the myths of Scotland. And we're going to start the podcast with American author Scott Westerfield. We sat down to talk to him about his Leviathan series and the steampunk world which he created.
Hi, I'm Scott Westerfeld, the author of the Leviathan series, and I'm probably best known for the Uglies series. Leviathan is set in 1914. It's basically an alternate World War I. In my world, Charles Darwin discovered DNA in the 1860s, so his book, Origins of Species, was actually a how-to manual. Over the last 50, 60 years, the Victorian Empire has been built on the backs of these fabricated beasts. And the Victorians use, message lizards rather than radios and fighting beasts. And they take to the skies in these sort of huge airships that are made from the life threads of a whale. So they're a sort of biotechnological Edwardian society. And against them are the Germans, the so-called clankers, the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians, who have these sort of walking tanks. And so it's sort of a more classic steampunk take on World War I. Metal against flesh.
Can you talk a little bit about, did you do a lot of research to find this, or is this pure imagination?
You know, it's a period I knew a lot about anyway, and I did a ton of research on, because we were changing such a massive amount of the world itself and making these sort of strange historical changes, I decided I wanted the war itself to be very true to the history. It sort of happens on a day-by-day basis. We did a lot of research on the clothing and all that stuff. One of the things that makes the book unusual is that it's illustrated. Because books back in 1914 all had pictures, whether they were for adults or for teenagers, they all had illustrations. So very early on in the process, I thought it would be cool to recapture that, that the sense of those old boys' own adventures. And so I got an illustrator named Keith Thompson who worked with me. And so, and I bring this up because you asked about research, and he's definitely a better researcher than I am. A lot of times there would be a gun, and I'd be like, oh, that's a Steiner pistol, right? Isn't that a little bit wrong? He's like, oh, you're thinking the 1912 Steiner pistol. This is the 1909 that was preferred by officers. So he was a total research geek, and the clothes and the uniforms are all super, super true to history, despite the fact that there's these giant flying whales and walking tanks in the background.
This is a young adult series, correct?
You know, it's designed for people 12 and up. Although the first piece of fan mail I got was from an officer in the Australian Army who had discovered it in a bookstore while he was shipping, an airport bookstore, while he was shipping out to Afghanistan and was passing it around the officer's club in Kabul or whatever. And it was it was really popular among that crew because, military history buffs tend to like it a lot as well as teenagers.
It's such a great thing. I love the way you can kind of, with fiction especially, go in and kind of recreate these worlds in this alternative universe. And I'm wondering, because with Uglies, you had this great explanation of why young people are attracted to this sort of world. You know, they're living in high schools and the aspects of a totalitarianism in kind of a high school regime, right? You can't do anything, you have no freedom, but at the same time, there's that lawless energy of kids bullying each other and Lord of the Flies-ness kind of in the same period. And I'm wondering, what's the reaction been from young people about this novel and this series?
One of the things that's interesting for teenagers about historicals is the fact that teenagers are a relatively recent invention. 100 years ago, if you were 14 or 15, you would be in the mines or married or maybe in the military. And one of my characters, Darren Sharp, is a Scottish girl who's pretending to be a boy so that she can serve in the military. And she's a midshipman on this sort of giant flying whale creature called the Leviathan. And of course, teenagers were given tremendous responsibilities 100 years ago and earlier. There was a 13-year-old who wound up in charge of a ship at Trafalgar because all the officers had been killed. So they were like, okay, you're the middy. You have the tailor now. The idea that you could go off on adventures and that you were independent at such a younger age back then is kind of makes historicals interesting to kids.
Are you conscious of writing for a younger audience when you're writing, or do you try to block that notion of your audience out? How aware of you as a writer are you that you're writing for people who are much younger than yourself?
Yeah, I do this experiment sometimes when I'm in front of a crowd of that's half teenager and half adult. And I say to the crowd, you know, raise your hands if you are studying a foreign language right now. And all the teenagers are, and not so many of the adults. And I say, well, have you written poetry in the last month? Yes, many teenagers have. You know, have you? Can you? Do you know the lyrics of 20 songs off by heart? Teenagers' hands go up. You know, do you call your friends by nicknames? Have you invented slang in the last month? Any conversation about language, the teens are actually doing more than the adults are. They're in the act of acquiring language and acquiring foreign languages and studying language, and because of that, they're a sort of more interesting group to write for linguistically. You can bombard them with new terms and, you know, dump slang on them and weird, you know, idiolects and dialects, and they absorb it and they enjoy it because their brains are still more plastic and more sort of, you know, they're still rewiring themselves all the time when it comes to language. So I am aware that I'm writing for teens, but it's not, I don't see it as a limitation or like I have to use some sort of reduced vocabulary because they're teenagers. In fact, it's adults I have to worry about vocabulary wise. You know, there's the old thing that you should only use said as a verb of utterance, because otherwise adults will get thrown out of the story. And all of the writing advice you get is about adults who are thrown out of the story when they see a word they don't recognize. And that's, you know, a characteristic of adult readers is that they're very fragile and they're very easy to alarm and to scare off, whereas teenagers are incredibly robust readers who can just keep going. Like when you see a teenager who's really into a book, they are like, you could drop a brick on their head and they will keep reading. And they're very voracious readers. They're very broad readers. Like you send like a 13-year-old to the library, they'll come back with a problem novel, a science fiction novel, a horror novel, and a nonfiction book about sharks. Whereas adults, they get really hyper-specialized, and they say, like, I only read John Grisham. I only read, you know, Matthew Riley. I only read Ursula Le Guin. And so I like the things that the teen audience brings.
Yeah, and it sounds interesting because actually when you're saying that, I was thinking about Leviathan and how it incorporates history and science and all of these different aspects of what people are interested in a really exciting way, in a steampunk way, I guess.
One of the biggest chunks of research I did was on airships. It's, you know, one of those perennial fascinations of alternate history and of history is these huge 1,000-foot-long, kind of strangely fragile constructions, some of the biggest things that people ever made, and yet tremendously fragile and kind of like easy to break. And they're wonderful sort of living experiments. You know, they can get caught under thermal inversions and that, you know, when it rains on them and the water builds up, like an inch of water on top of the Hindenburg weighed about 8 tons because it's 1,000 feet long, hundreds of feet across, and just the rain as it fall wouldn't run off fast enough. So it would add 8 tons to the weight of the Hindenburg when it was raining. So they would have to do all of these things, expand the gas bags, dump ballast in order to just survive a rainstorm. And it's all very sciencey too, and it's all, and you learn so much about the way the weather works and the way air density works and the way hydrogen works, and there's such fascinating constructions, and it's one of the things that I really enjoyed is all the stuff about how airships work, and I think, you know, by the end of the book, at the end of the trilogy, you really have a real understanding of that, and there's this sort of near disaster that it required all these educational moments beforehand to understand.
So the trilogy is finished.
There are 3 books, Leviathan, Behemoth, and Goliath. In the first one, they're mostly in over Europe. In the second one, they go to Constantinople or Istanbul, you know, visit the Ottoman Empire. In the third one, they go to Russia and Japan and the United States. Yeah, the trilogy's over, but we just came out with a 4th book, which is, as all trilogies do, which is an art book, which is the book, you know, the Keith and I did these deck plans because we're big nerds, and we did, you know, color illustrations of the uniforms and of the creatures. So we have this sort of technical manual that's all art and is for color, which came out after the trilogy. And yes, it's all available now.
Did you go up in a balloon of any sort?
I actually went up in a Zeppelin made by the Zeppelin Corporation. The only way place you can do that is you have to go to Friedrichshafen, Germany, and basically you go and you pay them a lot of money. You get to go up in a Zeppelin for like 4 hours, and it's so completely unlike anything else. When you're in a plane, you're like 30,000 feet in the air, and it's just everything's microscopic below you. But a Zeppelin only is going at about 1,000 feet, so it's like you're up at the top of a tall building moving around, and you're only going about 40 to 50 miles an hour. It's like being a bird, basically. That's the kind of flight characteristics that you have. And, you know, there are dogs in people's backyards who you can see barking at you, and, you know, you sort of going almost past these buildings and through these little towns. And of course, that's a beautiful part of Germany. And it's very silent and it's very smooth and nobody gets airsick. And it's a really wonderful way to fly. And they have a beautiful Zeppelin museum there, which is full of just the most awesome stuff ever. You can buy all kinds of great Zeppelin pins and T-shirts and stuff. And yeah, there's a few airships still left in the world. There's ones that do sort of ground radar for mining. There's ones that do sightseeing.
They have been talking about rebuilding one to.
Of course, airships these days are full of helium, so they're a lot less dangerous. I mean, they're certainly less dangerous than airplanes.
Did it feel precarious up there, like in the, or did it, because is it so vast that you don't notice that you're. Do you know what I mean? Like, did it feel like it didn't feel wobbly or anything? Did you get nervous from the. It's so old.
Yeah,
I couldn't imagine.
Well, it's a very modern Zeppelin. I mean, it has computer controls and all this stuff, and tilt rotors to move it around. One of the craziest things about it was when it comes back and the previous passengers get off, they don't all get off and then you get on. They get off two at a time. So two of them get off, and then two of you get on, and then two more get off, and two, because if they all got off, the thing would spring up into the air. I mean, that's what's so great. These things are like 1,000 feet long. I mean, the modern ones are only like 300 feet long, but the old ones were 1,000 feet long, and the crew would know if there was a stowaway, like a 5-year-old kid in the back. Like in Japan, this happened once, and the guys were like, "There's something wrong with the way we loaded the cargo or something," and they searched the ship and they found a 5-year-old kid. This is a machine that weighs, you know, dozens of tons. And it was so delicately balanced that you could detect the presence of a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old. You know, they're just really completely unlike any other vehicle you've been in.
Scott Westerfield, everybody. You can find his books at good libraries and bookshops everywhere. And of course, he's got a website, scottwesterfield.com. And while you're reading the internet, don't forget to stop by our own website, scottishbooktrust.com. On there, you'll find reading recommendations, stories, thought-provoking blog pieces, and much, much more. Next on the podcast, we stopped by the I Write Festival in Glasgow. We had a great time there hanging around the Mitchell Library, saw loads of events, and one of the exciting people we got a chance to talk to was Jerry Hassan. He's a writer, commentator, and academic in cultural policy at the University of the West of Scotland. His latest book is called Caledonian Dreaming, The Quest for a Different Scotland, and we sit down to talk about some of the myths and histories inherent in Scottish identity.
My name is Jerry Hassan, and I've just written and published a book called Caledonian Dreaming, The Quest for a Different Scotland. This is a really exciting time in Scotland, the independence debate, but I think even more than that, the independence debate's about a longer story, about Scotland changing as a society, becoming less deferential, less hung up, less the power of authority that many of us have known traditionally, historically, even in some cases grown up with. And I wanted to look at that. I wanted to put the independence referendum in that context. I wanted to even get beyond the independence referendum. This is not a book just for up until September the 18th. It's a book about kind of where that change is going, how we understand it and how it can be harnessed.
In the book, you kind of break down 6 myths of Scotland and 6 stories, I guess, yeah. Scotland tells itself.
How I began thinking about the myths of modern Scotland, I suppose it's something I've been thinking about for a while, but what really crystallised my thinking on this was the writing of the Irish writer Fintan O'Toole in his 2 books after Ireland's crash. And he wrote these 2 books, Ship of Fools and Enough is Enough. And he argued in that Ireland's myths, Ireland as a republic, Ireland as this land that didn't like British imperialism, really contributed towards the crash, towards a kind of complacency. And I thought, you know, Ireland, Scotland, very different in many, many ways. Our experience of our crash and theirs very different as well. And I began to think about the myths that define us. And by those, I mean, these are so obvious that they're ingrained in Scotland. And I think in a way they're then unexplored, unchallenged. The idea that we are an egalitarian country, the idea that we're this land of educational opportunity where the Kirriemuir career, the Lad of Parts, you know, the democratic intellect, that you can make it being working class from a poor background, disadvantaged background, to the top of Scotland, a story with great historical resonance. The idea that we systematically challenge power and authority. Well, if you look at recent Scotland and things like the banking crash, Glasgow Rangers Football Club, ad nauseum, it doesn't really hold up. So I wanted to say, these stories matter, these myths matter. They don't match the reality And what do we kind of do about it? Do we want to be defined by these values? Because if we do, and many people do, we need to take a reality check on the gap between what we tell ourselves and who we really are at the moment.
Because basically we're talking about stories, aren't we? Mm. We're talking about stories people tell themselves about who they are and where they come from. They have to serve somebody, and it sounds like they're not serving the people. Who are they serving?
That's a very good question, and there's a number of constituencies that those stories serve. The most obvious one is they tell us a comforting story about ourselves. They didn't come from nowhere. They didn't come from somewhere external. They came from various Scottish traditions around the experience of the Kirk, collectivism, the Labour Party, socialism, and of course our relationship with England. But who they serve most really, I think, is elite Scotland and establishment Scotland, and those are bigger groups than I think many would think. These include large parts of the public sector, large parts of the left, and nationalist Scotland. And they've kind of bought into these comforting stories. And really, in a way, what they tell us is that for all our stories, one of the ultimate stories that draws all these together is the idea of radical Scotland. And radical Scotland is a story, really, not a reality. Radical Scotland has been, with exceptions, obviously, rather conservative, rather unchallenging to power, with the exception of the odd, you know, the odd historical moments, Red Clydeside, etc., that are kind of misappropriated or overclaimed for. Our story has been not telling truth to power, not systemically investigating power, not challenging it. And sometimes, I think even on a more basic level, not even interested in the collective weight and implications of our own decisions.
You know, as an American, I look at it, you know, I think about the national myths of say, America and Americana. You know, again, some of them are quite similar, right? You can work your way up from your bootstraps, an egalitarian society, that kind of idea, equality. But of course, none of that is actually true. But then the myths that you tell yourselves as a country, at some point, does the population, the populace not say, okay, well, actually, we want to be like this. Mm. How do we do that? And do you see some of that occurring now? It seems like you feel like there is some self-determination creeping in and growing in Scotland.
What I've tried to do is say this is the longer story of Scotland going back many, many decades, and also then the stories of recent years in Scotland. I think it's absolutely right to say that what's happened in the last few years, and the independence debate has come from this and then been a catalyst, is that we're beginning to look at some of the decisions we're making. What I'm interested in is that bigger debate. I am not interested in debate about an arid, narrow constitution, what flag we put up the pole or the order of them. It's more about the kind of Scotland that we want to live in.
Do you find that there's room for that debate?
Yes and no, to an extent. One of the things I have been hugely energised and felt optimistic about in the last couple of years is we've had this long run into the referendum since 2011, and what you've seen because of that, I think it's an unintended consequence, is, you know, lots and lots of groups self-organising, self-generating, setting themselves up. I call these groups the Third Scotland, because what I mean by that is you've got a debate between two establishments. The old Labourish establishment, who are a bit in crisis and lost their way, and this bright, shiny promise of the SNP / nationalist establishment. And that's quite a narrow debate for most of us. And this Third Scotland, I'm thinking of groups like National Collective, I'm thinking of things like the Radical Independence Campaign, Jimmy Reid Foundation. There's a lot of young, energising voices in that. There's a lot more women. And it speaks a much wider politics and sense of possible. I mean, to take an example of the narrow versus the wide, the SNP have consistently framed independence as being about the full powers of the parliament. I think that's a very, very narrow notion of independence and basically politics. Those groups are about kind of politics as kind of cultural power, as soft power, about how you change the kind of psychologies of a nation. So if you take the fact that Scotland is dramatically changing, and you even take it in the narrow time frame of the last 30, 40 years, just before that 30, 40 years, we were an enormously deferential, hierarchical society where there was a power of authority. It used to be embodied in the Kirk, then it became embodied in kind of like the local Labour Council. That has all begun to weaken, and this is part, of course, of a changing sense of the UK, the West. This is the Scottish manifestation of the kind of crisis of traditional authority. How we've experienced that, and just even in the last few years, is we have seen the crash of Royal Bank of Scotland, once the fifth biggest bank in the world. We have seen the collapse of Glasgow Rangers Football Club, historically the dominant club in Scotland, the most successful club in Scotland. And we've seen the Catholic Church mired in scandal at the highest level. This I don't think is an accident. This is all a manifestation of these crises of authority. So that brings up all sorts of flux, change, uncertainty for some people. I think some people, some older people, find it a bit unsettling, the whole thing, those changes, the independence debate. But I think it can only be a good thing because we're remaking what it means to be authority, what it means to have kind of power. And really the question that comes from that is, what does good authority look like in Scotland? What does good power? Who has voice? Who has legitimacy? That is all moving in a way that used to be very, very narrow casted and have a narrow bandwidth of possible voices. So we are leaving that old Scotland behind, and it's kind of unsettling, I think, for some.
Because it's hard to leave a myth behind, to leave a story you've told yourself behind. What do we do? What do people do with these old myths, these six myths that you've talked about in your book? What do they do with them? Do we just put them back up on Mount Olympus, yeah, send them to Brigadoon and just forget about them? Or
we define that we want to act on them. There's this profound disabling mismatch or gap between what we say we are and our action because we don't implement it.
Live your dream.
Well, yes, and well, in fact, I've got a whole chapter in the book about the power and indeed the limits of dreams. But dreaming, actually, you see, there's a power in dreams, which is wonderful and enabling. But there's also a limit because the Scots have loved to dream historically, but then not act on it. That's the double meaning of my title, Caledonian Dreaming. We have had lefts and radicals who have dared to dream. We have told ourselves a selective story. Scotland, I've got this again. Deliberately provocative point, set of points, that the United Kingdom is not a fully fledged democracy. That should be obvious to anyone but, you know, the people at the highest points of institutions, because, you know, we've got the House of Lords, the monarchy, large bits of feudalism kicking about. But I argue that Scotland is not a democracy because we've never had a democratising moment. And this debate is, in the widest sense, part of trying to democratise Scotland. So far, lots of our radicals, left, nationalists, have colluded and been happy to have this selective democracy or to buy into the myths and not even realise these wider truths. And I think this debate is a chance, and some of this coming to, you know, fruition, and a chance for us to finally democratise Scotland, which of course isn't just about the verdict on September the 18th, yes or no, it's something much deeper than that. There isn't a right or a wrong judgment on that.
Jerry Hassan, everybody. You can find out more about what Jerry's up to by following him on Twitter at Jerry Hassan. And don't forget, you can also follow us, the Scottish Book Trust, at Scottish BK Trust. We'll be looking out for you in the Twitterverse. Lastly on the podcast, we stopped by the Edinburgh International Science Festival and heard a fascinating conversation between crime writer Lynn Anderson and forensic psychologist Dr. Kathy Charles. And here they are at Summer Hall talking a little bit about how crime writing and science work together.
I'm Dr. Kathy Charles, and I'm a lecturer in forensic psychology at Edinburgh Napier University.
My name's Lynn Anderson, and I'm an author specialising in crime books. My main character is a forensic scientist, so I have a number of people that I work with who give me all the insights into the stuff I make up, really.
So is it always that way? You make something up, and then you have it kind of checked, or do you ever get, because it's such a rich field, and there must be so much going on, and the imagination of on both sides is great. And I wonder if you're pulling things in from just the world of forensic psychology and thinking, that changes everything about my book. I have a new scene. I've got a new character.
Yeah, I think when you're thinking about the psychology of why something happens, I think that's where the whole forensic psychology comes into action. On the latest book, I sat a long time asking her questions about certain characteristics. I was looking at the world of game playing and the psychology behind various games.
As you were going through the book and double checking things, were there minor details, or was it? I think as like a layman and somebody who doesn't really know anything about forensic psychology or psychology in general, like we've got things from TV shows and other novels and books and journalism, and then there's a preconception. And I wondered how much of it is just a little bit of finesse and fine tuning in terms of like going over somebody's novel and trying to be like, okay, this would be more realistic if you did this, or was it just wildly off?
That's very difficult to answer because I don't go through a novel and look to sort of correct it. It's more about the discussion of a theme or a concept or a possible scenario. So it isn't like going through things with a fine tooth comb. And I don't think Lynn would really want her novels being gone through by loads of different people. Yes, it's because obviously it's also about entertainment and telling a good story. So it's really just about, this is a potential scenario. Is this the kind of thing that might happen? So it's more about general ideas really and concepts.
Are there times where you're aware of your own preconceptions about what is and what isn't a psychopathic person, where you then have to go back and go, oh, okay, that wasn't really a trait. That was something I thought was a trait of a psychopath. Mm-hmm. But actually, you know, science has proven that it's not, and I need to rewrite that character, rewrite that scene a little bit more gently.
What I've done with the psychopathic characters, I do a lot of reading beforehand, and then I sort of extract out of that what would work within the scenario. And probably one of the best books ever was a literary book called East of Eden, and the psychopathic personality there is just astonishing. And I always remember it, and it made me want to write about a character like that.
Oh, really? It's Steinbeck, right? Yep. I didn't realize there was
Absolutely. It is. In fact, I would say reading Steinbeck, I think I read that book for the first time before I had any children. And then I thought seriously about whether I would ever want any children. Because the truth is, you cannot foretell that somebody's going to become a psychopath. And it's really nothing to do with the way they're brought up. And the child in East of Eden who becomes the female psychopath is a real study of it. So that sort of drew me to it. And when I started to involve a psychologist in my books, I remembered that, and then I went reading, and it convinced me even more. I'd had all my kids by now, so, you know, I'd faced the danger.
I think that's really interesting that's the example that fascinated you. It's very hard in a piece of fiction to try and depict these biological, highly scientific differences. And if you look at the early work on psychopaths, so stuff like Cleckley's book from the 1940s, it is really much more narrative, much more of a narrative style. And it is about describing characters, describing their interactions with other people. And I think that actually presents a much more engaging version of it than the science does. It's easy for me because I do a lecture and I can say whatever I like and they're all stuck listening to me. But if you're reading things for pleasure, you want it to be about interpersonal relationships, not really just lists of hard science, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. And also, I guess the narrative creates empathy. Certainly, as a writer, you have to have a degree of empathy towards all the characters that you're writing, whether or not you detest them in some way or not. For your job, do you have to have a degree of empathy?
I think when you're doing an interview with somebody, you have to be able to show some sort of sensitivity, and in that sense some empathy to get them to talk to you and to make the situation pleasant. But I find it pretty difficult to understand what some of these people do. I couldn't put myself in their position and think, oh yeah, I might do that, because sometimes it's too bad, you know. It's not easy to empathize with what they do, but you can show some empathy to facilitate your interviewing or getting to hear what happened, I suppose.
That doesn't lead you to empathize with the acts.
I guess you can understand the thinking in quite a mechanical sort of way. So you can read about either biology or experiences that are thought to create this kind of person, and then you can think, well, this is why he did that or why she did that. So you can understand it mechanically, but I don't understand it as in thinking, yeah, I would have done that, or I can understand it. So in Lynn's novel, where she has the character who's killed his son, and we do hear about these cases, unfortunately, quite often, of very young children being killed, and often because people are on drugs and they're indifferent to their safety, etc. I can understand the mechanics of that, but I have no sympathy with those individuals. I can't envisage ever doing that myself. So it's quite mixed, I would say.
The book is called,
I think Kathy's talking about it at the moment, is one we used tonight at our event, and it, because it has a very strong sort of interviewing scene between a psychologist and a psychopath, and we used it as an example to describe how to deal with that situation and the characteristics of a psychopath. So in that particular book was The Reborn. The one that we talked a lot about comes out in August, and it's called The Paths of the Dead, and it has a very powerful psychological story attached to it. So we discuss some of the ideas associated with that, the type of character who would be involved in what's depicted in The Paths of the Dead. I should say that Kathy hasn't read the book yet because it's not out there, but she definitely played a role in it.
Yeah.
The Paths of the Dead takes place around a number of sites in Scotland, which are Neolithic sites. And the perpetrator is involved in playing an online a reality game. And so he's playing against, he's recruited people to play it. And he's playing against the authorities. So that sort of psychological thing about how he was controlling the investigation was obviously very important to the telling, and when he released information and how it just spread like wildfire because it was all online and he got everybody involved in it, which takes the police, you know, they have to deal with that. So he's manipulating them all.
Lynn Anderson and Dr. Kathy Charles, everybody. Thanks to them for sitting down and taking the time to talk with us at Summer Hall during the Edinburgh Science Festival. Lynn is also the co-founder of Bloody Scotland, Scotland's international crime writing festival that takes place in Stirling in September. It's a great festival, very exciting. They have writers from around the world. Go visit it in September. And before then, you can check out their website at bloodyscotland.com, or you can like them on Facebook. They've got a page there. Just look up Bloody Scotland. And while you're on Facebook, don't forget to like our Scottish Book Trust page. Just give us a like, and we'll keep you up to date on all the exciting book news happening in and around Scotland. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Scott Westerfield and the Brisbane Writers Festival. Thanks to Jerry Hassan and I Write in Glasgow. And thanks to Lynn Anderson and Dr. Kathy Charles and the Edinburgh International Science Festival. It was a pleasure being with you all. And thank you for listening. It was great to be in your ears. Take the earbuds out and put a book in front of your face and enjoy sinking into a good book for a little while. We'll be back in your ears very, very soon. Goodbye for now.